Good morning, everybody. My name is Anne Schmidt, and I'm with the Earth Care Group at IMC. And welcome to the special section about Let Nature Teach You. We have some chatter. I'm not sure what that is, but okay. So Aya Santusike is here, and Aya Chittananda, and they are with Karuna Buddhist Vihara. And what Aya Santusike is a Buddhist nun, and she was ordained in 2012 as a bhikkhuni, and she now lives in the hermitage, which she founded. She trained on three continents. I thought that was pretty impressive. In the Thai forest tradition, with the teacher monasteries of Ajahn Chah and his disciples. So she's in Boulder Creek, and we welcome her. We welcome all. And the last thing I want to say is that you should know that this session is being recorded. So thank you all, and over to you, Aya Santusike. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here. For those people who ordinarily join us at this time on 10 o'clock on Saturdays, we still are going to be looking at how do I apply the Dhamma to this, but it's a special session for IMC, looking at our Earth and kicking off Earth Week, Vipassana Earth Week. So really, I think the point of coming together today is to really try to look at the state of our natural environment and what we can learn from it, and recognize, remind ourselves that our entire life depends upon this environment and the state of this planet. And then to really see what actions we can take, how we can help restore our natural environment. And so we're going to do some meditation, and I see that many of you are out in a natural setting, and maybe that's a little why our technology was a little challenging this morning, but here we are. Outside instead of inside, and it is a beautiful day. I don't know if where you are you have clean air or if it's smoky outside, but all of these conditions of our natural world are part of what we want to turn towards this morning. And so I think we'll start with some meditation, and settle in. So find a comfortable position. And then after the meditation, I'll offer some words of reflection, and there'll be time for us to discuss. And all kinds of questions are welcome at that point. So as we find a comfortable position with our spine straight, and turn our attention inwards. Putting our attention on our breath. And on our body. We can observe our in-breath and our out-breath. Just, it's enough to just know now I'm breathing in and now I'm breathing out. And we don't have to think in breath and out breath every time, but we kind of feel it. We come to be so present with the breathing that we can really just feel in breath and out breath. And if the breath is a difficult object for you, then use some other place, some point in the body or even the whole body as you're grounding. And you can put your attention just on your belly. Or just on your heart center. Whatever point of focus helps to become calm and at ease. And as we are aware of our body, we turn our mind inward. We can still observe changing conditions. We can notice our heart beating, perhaps. Can feel the changes that come from the in-breath and the out-breath. There might be other sensations in the body that are changing. We also might notice the changing conditions outside the body. We can be aware of our breathing and still, at this point in the meditation, hear the sound. When we meditate indoors, we can often do things to help quiet the environment. So when we meditate outdoors, it's entirely out of our control. And that is the natural state of things. Most things are not in our control. And then we have a choice. We can decide how to react, respond, or reflect. We can allow external stimuli to encourage us to turn more deeply inwards. that there is a stillness inside. As we go deeper into meditation. You can locate a stillness that is not dependent upon external conditions. And if it feels like such a still point is far away, then the first thing to do is relax. Because the way to that stillness is through letting go. It's not through effort. No intention is needed and guiding the mind is necessary. But we can't strive our way to stillness. Clarity, perseverance, and kindness help us. Encouraging the mind to settle, the body to become tranquil, and to be at ease and at peace inside. Letting all the change processes ongoing activity, let it slip to the background. As we ground ourselves with our meditation focus, at ease and at peace, holding on to nothing. And now as we come closer to the end of our meditation, we can expand our awareness to our environment, taking in the feeling of the air on our skin, taking in whatever sounds there may be, noticing that we are situated in a context. Context that affects us, and also that we influence. We can't really separate ourselves from that context fully, and we cannot control it fully. But we can be aware and present. And also loving and kind. So welcome back to the world. Going to shift my position a little, so maybe I can be a bit more in the light, or maybe I'm a bit more computer at the shift. A little better. Can you hear me okay? Yep. Yeah. The lighting is beautiful here, but I'm not sure quite where the computer needs to look. Anyway, I just want to really let you know how much I appreciate your being here this morning. And I want to have a really frank conversation about our situation. And frank doesn't mean it's all doom and gloom. There's a lot to be really inspired by and hopeful for. So I'll start with some reflections, and then we'll open it up to conversation. And I want to start with the lessons that we learn from nature. And you, I'm sure, have your own list. But I think it might be nice to really consider what it is that nature teaches us and how we might, as practitioners, open up to more of what nature can provide in that regard in terms of the Dhamma. So of course, one obvious lesson that we gain from nature is about change and impermanence. It's constant. And considering the things that have been happening this year to all of us, impermanence is really in our face. So that's an obvious one. Nature also clearly reveals dukkha. We see it everywhere. The suffering or the discomfort or the uncertainty, the not quite satisfying aspect of the natural life. One of the things that I think is a little harder for us to accept as human beings is that nature shows us, sometimes very dramatically, that things are not in our control. Now, this is a place where human beings have really been striving for maybe forever to gain the upper hand on nature, to bring it under our control. I don't think it was like this always. I can imagine, and you might well imagine, and maybe you have the kind of background in study that is way beyond mine in terms of like how we developed as human beings. But with my limited knowledge, I think about what it must have been like to be in the hunter-gatherer phase. Oh, by the way, I believe we probably all were there in some form. in some previous incarnation, existence, rebirth. But without that, we can just imagine perhaps what it might have been like to be living so embedded in nature that we're really just looking for ways to survive, what to eat. I'm sure that human beings at that time had to be extremely tuned in to when something, you know, when the berries are ripe, when the roots are ready to eat, and how to find meat, and, you know, just so many actual, you know, kind of teachings that must have been part of their daily life. And for us, Ayachitananda and me, we were living in town for most of the existence of our monastery. And then a year ago, we moved out into the forest. And it's been an enormous source of wonderful support for our investigating the Dhamma. So as you can see, we're out here. This is the redwoods in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and the wind, the rain, or the lack of it. Right now, our water source has gone dry, almost completely dry. We get our water from a spring, and it's so dry here, it's almost completely diminished to nothing. And the fire, there was one of the big fires was about 4 or 5 miles from us. Smoke in the air sometimes. It's actually been very light here. I can smell it a little bit today. I hope it's not too bad where you are right now. But it's a constant reminder that for us here, we're off the grid, so our basic utilities, the basic needs of water, power, warmth, cooling, forget that. We just have to, you know, like, go down to the creek and get as close to the coolness as you can if necessary. But it's really a reminder of how things are not in our control and how adjusting to the rhythm of nature is helpful. And then, of course, humanity started to make use of nature in more extensive ways with farming. And some of you know I grew up on a farm in the Midwest. And it was during a period when there was a lot of attention on progress. My father loved the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, where we could look at the first cotton gin or something like it, or the story of how they developed a, you know, harvesting machine, you know, and the ways in which human beings made progress in using nature, animals for their milk and meat, you know, breeding animals and developing cross-pollinating seeds and developing and pushing nature to be more sort of quote-unquote productive. And the result in my lifetime and in many for you also, going from what 2.5 billion people on the planet to something like 7 something. It's a huge, huge change. And so it's all that progress in utilizing nature and then moving more and more into the realm of controlling or trying to control nature. And as we've seen, there are limits. Even though we can find vaccines, we've very ingeniously come up with so many ways to improve health and mitigate disease, and increase the abundance of food. There are these downsides, but it's really helpful. I don't know how it lands for you, but it's helpful for me to reflect on, how understandable it is that we would walk down this path, and that as a species with the mental and creative abilities that we have, why we would, get to the place that we are with regard to the things that we've produced and the way that we've developed our economies and our lifestyles. We would really like for everything to be comfortable and pleasant all the time. And that's really what humanity has been striving to do, right? We want our environment inside to be climate controlled. We want our food to be, healthy and tasty and available without having too much trouble to gain it. And so all of these efforts to try to make things better have their downside. And as practitioners, we know it's never going to be achievable fully. It doesn't mean, and I would hope that this comes with a kind of acceptance and maybe interest in how we operate, and without blame for where we've gotten to, because it's really understandable. And then, to be willing to look at the problems. And I think for many people right now, we're dealing with so much, a pandemic, fires, political turbulence, and to name a few, that maybe our concerns for the environment have been kind of relegated to the shadows. And I think all along, I started getting really interested in climate change, in particular around 2006. And some of you might know that I used to talk about it a lot, and I have been doing less of that over the last few years. And I think maybe people feel like either we're doing what we can through our individual efforts, recycling, getting fuel efficient vehicles, and there are lots of good things that we can do. And maybe we feel a bit hopeless around bigger changes, policy changes, and being able to influence people in leadership positions. We're going to talk about that more in a minute. But when we let things slip into the shadows, as practitioners, we all know what, and even people who are not Dhamma practitioners, who are savvy and knowledgeable about human psychology, we know that when things get relegated to the shadows, when problems are kind of shoved down, we know what happens. They fester there. And the Buddha, in all of his wisdom, he said, you have to turn towards it. That's the first noble truth. There's suffering here. There are issues here. We have to look at them. We have to really be willing to open ourselves up to them and see where the clinging is, where the craving is, where the discontent is, so that we can work our way through it. And the result of that, on the one hand, very important result, is that we accept. And this is something we can learn from nature too. There's an acceptance. But it doesn't mean that we just, you know, roll over and resign ourselves. That's not the Buddha's point. His point is, you fully take in where you are, and then you do something about it. So nature shows us that we not only face what's happening, accept what's there, but then we also really employ our ability to be resilient and to persevere. I was reading Ajahn Chah's biography, the one that Ajahn Jayasaro wrote, Stillness Flowing. If you haven't seen it, I would recommend going to our website. I think it'll appear, the link will appear in the chat at some point, if not already. And I came across a story of when Ajahn Chah was wandering as a forest monk alone in the forest. And he did this for a long time, practicing on his own, really living in nature. Of course, he'd walk for alms in villages. But there's this story where he had not had food for a few days, several days. He was walking in the mountains and his legs were rubbery. And he was weak, and he, a fever hit. He got a fever, and he just kind of laid down on the ground, and he was thinking about, you know, he knew he had very little water with him, and he was just kind of giving up. And then the thought came to him that when he dies, if he dies there, someone will find him and they'll let his family know, and then how inconvenient it will be for them to have to come for such a long way to get the body. And he looked into his bag and he got out his ID and he thought, okay, when things get really bad, I'll burn it, or I'll destroy it so they can't tell, so no one will know whose body this is. And as he was laying there, he heard this deer barking in the forest. And he said it caused him to think, well, do animals get sick? Of course they do. And what do? They don't have any doctors to take care of them. They don't have any injections to help them get better. And that kind of pulled him out of his despair. And he sat up and he drank a little bit of water and he started to meditate. And he meditated through the night, and then his fever broke and he was able to go on. And, you know, for him, wandering in the wilderness, being in nature, he was using everything that he encountered as a support for developing in the Dhamma. And that's what we all need to do. That there is nothing that happens to us that is outside the Dhamma, if we choose to look at it in that way. That we too can be resilient and persevere. We too can take in and look at whatever is happening to us, whatever is coming up in the mind, whatever feelings arise in the body. We can put them in the context of Dhamma, including this little fly that's flying right in my face. And, you know, there's something we can learn there. And it helps to go out into nature to feel the hugeness of it, I think it helps to reflect on the fact that these fires that we're experiencing now are so enormous, so out of control for human beings with all of their equipment and chemicals, retardants and aircraft and everything. I mean, what I really noticed about this fire, so we had this fire here, as you probably know, near Boulder Creek, California. It burnt down Big Basin Park, and I don't know, 90,000 acres or something. And that was a small one compared to some of the others happening east of San Jose and north of San Francisco. You know, we had, and we still do, have these raging fires also in Oregon. And they're huge. And what I noticed was that the firefighters were really, they did a great job, but there was no way they could control this fire for many, many days, that it would be, you know, like 5% contained, 8% contained. Some days would pass with no more, you know, ability to contain it. And yet they were able to create lines where they would keep the fire at bay without actually being able to stop it. And at the end of the, I don't know, 35 days or whatever it was, every day we would listen, pretty much every day we would listen to the reports from CAL FIRE about, you know, in the morning and the evening about the progress that was being made, their intentions for the next shift, you know, what the evacuation and warning situations were. And we had evacuated. We actually stayed with Ann and Ed. It was so wonderful. And this is another thing to consider for yourselves. We have friends in the Dhamma. We have, as human beings, Dhamma practitioners or not, we have this tendency to help each other. And we have this ability to do a lot, even when things are really grim, to be of service, to be kind, to support each other. And it brings a kind of spiritual inspiration and uplift, a touching into what's larger than our life, than even this planet. But having said that, coming back to the firefighters, the chief, one of the fire chiefs that spoke every day, talked at the end about a little bit about his career answering questions from an interviewer. And he had been a firefighter for 35 years and working for CAL FIRE, I think, for that long. And he said that in the early years, they had a fire that was burned 2,000 acres. And he said, we all thought this is the fire of a lifetime. We're never going to see this again. This is huge. This is like really, really pushing us to strive to manage this fire. And then, of course, now we see fires that are, you know, so much larger. And he said that of the 10 largest fires in California, he has fought 7 of them. And all 10 of those have been in the last 10 years. He was talking about, he said, call it global warming, call it climate change, call it whatever you want, but something has changed. Now we have these mega fires. And it's important for us to pay attention, which I'm sure is like why you joined this call today and you weren't like, oh no, I don't want to hear about that. Because again, if we put it in the shadows, it grows. Even the simplest emotional sort of experience, if we push it into the shadows, it grows. If we bring it out into the daylight, it shrinks. We have a chance of managing it, of coming to it, of learning from it, of developing in ourselves as we help others and the situation. So there are a number of things that I hope to share with you around this. One of them is a link about pandemics. And I'm including it here because it points to how pandemics arise, which it comes from nature, right? From animals or other living beings with certain viruses or pathogens that then come into the human population. So the link, I think, is in your chat window, and it says how to stop the next pandemic is the title, and it's a video that I would encourage you to watch. And they talk about how the number of pandemics has increased over the years. So there's always been, you know, pandemics that come through, but now we have them more often. And that it comes not just because people are doing something they probably shouldn't do or any of that, but it comes because we have so many people on the planet now, and we are pushing so much farther into natural environments that you'll have like bats living in a forest setting where they're away from human beings. But then as the farms move out farther, we're cutting the forest, the bats start to being closer and closer in. Their droppings go into the pig pens, and then the virus makes it into the pig population, and from there into the human population. And so this too is about human behavior and how we are pressing in on natural environments and therefore touching into what then can be something that's quite dangerous for us. And so you'll see in the video that there is an idea for how to be proactive and ready for those pathogens as they become unleashed in the human population. So that's one thing to consider. And again, for me, this takes away some of the blame, so that, you know, we recognize that our actions, all of us collectively, bring about some of these situations. And it's not to blame ourselves, but to just see how naturally that comes about, given the fact that we do want comfort. We do want more family and children. And, you know, we've increased the population in quite an understandable way. It's not anyone else's fault. And it's not to be taken as, oh, I'm so bad. This is important about karma, that we recognize not to be, you know, not to introduce guilt and blame, but to just become more and more present and aware with the way things fall in cause and effect. This is how it is. Another thing I want to turn or point out, give you a link for, is a program that's called, well, it was the second annual Global Climate Restoration Forum that just happened in mid-September. And they really talk about wonderful solutions that people are and companies are developing. I would encourage that you look at the session number 3. It's called Climate Restoration Solutions. And you see there that they have several companies talking about what they're developing. And in particular, there are solutions for pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. So they've realized that it's not enough for us to just slow down our burning of fossil fuels, although we need to do that more and more, and we are making progress. But that they also have ways of pulling the carbon out of the atmosphere so that we can turn back the clock, you might say, on the pollutants that exist in our atmosphere, that we can start to really make a difference with the rising of our global temperature. One of the solutions sounds almost, it sounds to me like a wonderful result. They take a certain kind of rock that comes from volcanoes. I think it's called olivolite or something like that. It's a green rock that's very, very common. It's on every continent, easily mined because it's close to the surface. And if you crush the rock and you put it on the beach, the ocean waves come and pull it into the ocean and pulverize it some more, and it causes a chemical reaction that pulls CO2 out of the air, pulls it out of the atmosphere, and it also reduces the acidity in the ocean. They're working on testing it now to make sure that it's harmless. As far as they can tell, it's completely natural process. We've just accelerated by pulling the green rocks to the ocean and letting nature take its course. Coral reefs revive, the acid reduces, the carbon comes out of the atmosphere, and there's a restoration. So these kinds of solutions are very much an attempt to use the natural power of the environment to clean itself up. And this is part of what we see in nature. There is a kind of, it will take a long time if we allow nature, even if we completely step out of the picture and stop producing pollutants, it will take a long time to recover, but maybe we can accelerate that in a dramatic way. There's another company that's pulling carbon out of the atmosphere in a different way and turning the carbon into building materials. It makes concrete much stronger, and it's forever encapsulated there. So all of these things can be looked into to see, like, how, you know, solid is this work. It sounds really good. I mean, we've been told, as long as I've been looking at the climate problem, we've been told we have the technology, but we don't have the political will. It took me a long time to figure out what that was a euphemism for. It's around politicization of climate, of the environmental problems, politicization of, now we see the pandemic, politicized. This is a very, very big problem, because we need to look at these issues as something that we need to address as a human population, not ignore, lie about and pretend it's not there or that it's not caused by what we do, because we can change this. We can change this. So we don't have to be partisan about it either. We need to depoliticize these issues and recognize that people with all different kinds of political ideologies have in the past been interested in mitigating climate change. And I'm sure people with all different kinds of political views want to work through this pandemic in a way that's going to be beneficial for everyone. And so we need to encourage policymakers, because it has also become clear that our individual efforts, while helpful, aren't enough. That what we need is broad policy to change things. It's something that we really have to pull together on. And one of the quotes that I wrote down, let me see where I have it. I may not have it in front of me. Let's check. I need a quote that came. Yeah, I don't have it here, but the gist of it is this person who is, let me see, maybe I, no, it's not going to be on this computer. Okay. The person, one of the people who's working in the company, actually the head of the company that's pulling the carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it into building materials, he said that California legislation on climate change is the best in the world. He said it is the, he's from Canada. This company is in Canada. He said California is the most forward-looking, the most creative, and the legislation that we now have in California is the best. So it's something we, as if you're in California, congratulate yourself, because we've encouraged this in our government. And if you're not in California, then we can encourage the people that are making policy to look to what California has been doing as a way to go forward and to really make a difference. And so there is a lot that we can do. We can do it from our living room, like we're doing everything else these days. Some of the people at this global forum talked about how they were concerned in the beginning with the pandemic that people would really drop interest in the environment. And they said, that's really not what's happening. Maybe because people have more time, or maybe because we have the resources to reach out more over the internet, but people are doing things that we can actually, you know, do. We can encourage companies, we can encourage our political representatives, and we can talk about what's really happening. And we can learn. As practitioners of the Dhamma, we can learn what all of this has to teach us about letting go, about tuning into our own internal resources, to relying on the Buddha, Dhamma, and enlightened Sangha for our grounding and support, our refuge, and that we can take that level by level, not just for a better situation in the world, but also for our own awakening. So now we have 45 minutes, and I hope you have a lot to say, because a lot of times it's what you say that you're going to remember and other people will remember, and that actually a lot of times it's questions that bring the deeper Dhamma out into the open. So I'm gonna look to Aya Chittananda, who's on the other side of the screen, and she can tell me whose hand is up. If you could raise your hand on the computer, I know it's in different places for different people on the program, but Anne has her hand up. Anne, go ahead.
So I just want to say thank you. It's so sweet to see you sitting there and the redwood trees blowing and a butterfly went by. It's just really precious. So first of all, thank you for that. And practically, I'd like to know how we can copy from the chat. And that's a technical question. I think the chat goes away at the end, but I want to try and copy some of those resources so I can follow on.
I think if you just select them and copy the way you would ordinarily copy something, does that work, Aya? Yes, that's the way to do it. Okay. Just do your usual copy-paste magic.
Okay, fine. Then I have to not lose you, because thank you. Okay.
I think you won't lose me. Okay. Does everybody know how to pull up the chat window? I think there's an icon at the bottom of the screen that says chat. And I think there you'll see the things. Oh, there's one more thing I'd like to mention, and this is important. I don't know if you know the work of Lester Brown. He's an incredible agronomy economist. Anyway, he has the incredible background as in farming, in economics, and in the environmental sciences, and he was a policymaker for decades and an advisor to policymakers, and he wrote a series of books a long series and many books about climate change and what we need to do. His books, the one that I think I found most helpful was Plan B. It was revised a few times. But he really lays out in a very good way what we need to do. He had identified a four-pronged approach. One, reducing our carbon emissions dramatically. He said it's important to eliminate poverty in order to have a stable environment. I found that incredibly uplifting. And, you know, from our perspective with kindness and compassion, what a wonderful thing it would be to eliminate poverty. And I know we're living in samsara. How useful or how possible is this? We're never going to be able to eliminate greed, hatred, and delusion in this realm. However, there's a lot we can do if that becomes a priority for our nations. And it's good to read what he has to say about it and how that has a strong impact on the environment to eliminate poverty and also to stabilize world population growth. And one of the things that's very inspiring about that is it's really related to a large degree in how women are treated in our world and how much if women are educated, if women are given a say in their government, then they have fewer children. If they're given good medical care, they will have fewer children. Their children will be more likely to survive. And it's a positive movement all around to uplift women. And then the fourth piece of Lester Brown's program is to restore our natural systems, our oceans, our forests, our farmland, our air, that when we restore these, of course, that's absolutely essential. So there we have the map. I mean, that was what he was doing with much of his life force over the decades. He's now 86, I think. He retired 5 years ago at 81. And he's what he has left or what he has given us is incredibly important as a roadmap to recovery from the deviation that has been kind of driving us off the road here into dangerous territory. I think you also might find in the chat window the reference to stillness flowing. If you don't have it, if it's not there, it will be.
Somebody has said that on the computer there's three little dots and you can click through the chat.
At the bottom of the chat window, there's three little dots and you can select save chat. And then you can just have it all right there for you. Yeah, great. Okay, what else do you have to say? Comments, complaints, questions, whatever. Just raise your hand. Or if you're on the phone, you can unmute yourself with *6. And I don't know if you can they unmute themselves? Yeah, you can unmute yourself if you want to speak. Or if you raise your hand, we can call on you. One of the things I noticed when I was traveling and staying in monasteries in Ajahn Chah's collection of monasteries, that when you're sitting around with a bunch of monks and nobody has anything to say, everybody just sits there. It's okay. So we can wait.
Good morning, it's Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Thank you for your sweet talk. I really appreciate it and resonated very much with how much nature is a wonderful teacher, and it's not in our control. And I also loved how you weaved in the Dharma. And one of my concerns about the Buddhist community is the lack of veganism. And I haven't been to the Thai Forest Monastery, so I have no idea how they roll. But Thich Nhat Hanh, since I think 1998, it's all vegan. But most of our meditation centers in the community is not. And some even bring in like meat stuff. And as someone who knows how harmful the commercial and meat industry is to our earth, it just surprises me and saddens me. And then lastly, I wanted to share, there is a microbiome soil suite speaker on environmentalism and biodiversity. His name is Zach Bush, MD, and I found him very, very sweet, because most of the vegans aren't. They're kind of angry, and he's just like kind of an angel, and he doesn't even talk about plant-based eating. He just talks about farming and the earth and climate change and other tidbits. So deep bows to you all, and thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Michael. That was really useful. I'll say a couple of words about the monasteries and veganism and vegetarianism. I don't know how many of you know that this was a big point of contention at the time of the Buddha. It was Devadatta, his cousin, who wanted to take over the Sangha from the Buddha, who made vegetarianism a political issue. And he was trying to divide the group based on that, because of course there is a definite pull from, you know, even though the Buddha said it's not against the moral precepts to eat meat. Of course, when we keep the five precepts and perhaps the 227 or the 311 of fully ordained monastics, your wish to not harm can be a very strong motivator to vegetarianism or veganism. And in fact, many of you may know, in the Chinese tradition, it's very, very strongly held, veganism in the monasteries. But in Thai forest tradition, you know, this Thailand, for a long time, it would be considered a developing country. And I think it's probably graduated to the next distinction in that regard. But a lot of people, especially, again, the forests in northeast Thailand, where Ajahn Chah was, people eat everything because they're poor. And there was one day when I was in a small branch monastery, when I had my bowl and I was going, being given food, and the main dish was this soup that had all these tiny little frogs in it. I mean, these frogs had to be like the size of a quarter, but the whole body, the whole frog, it was frog soup with the whole body in there. And that day I ate bananas and sticky rice. primarily, I think. And so it's not a requirement that people be vegan or vegetarian, but in individual monasteries, we can make that choice. So Karuna Buddhist Vihara is a vegetarian monastery. We have not been vegan. I personally find having eggs sometimes and dairy sometimes really helpful. And I know this is a kind of like personal choice, or oftentimes, you know, we're, you know, kind of like we have to make some compromises sometimes because of health. But to have it in mind that this is an issue, especially the way things farming is, you know, when I talked about farming, the changes in farming in my lifetime have been enormous. When I was growing up, that was when we were starting to move to factory farming. And during my youth, we saw many, many family farms, you know, dissolving into huge agribusiness organizations. There was one insurance company that was buying up all this farmland, and then they would farm it in ways that were much less sensitive to the environment. And all families with wells around the edge of their vast properties would go dry because they're irrigating areas that should really be left unworked, I would say, you know, not cultivated. And so there are all these, and the factory farming coming, becoming more and more of the routine way, packing so many animals into tight spaces that you have so many problems with disease, and you're pumping them with all kinds of medicines and chemicals, and it's just a real problem. So the degree to which we can reduce our meat and dairy consumption, I think, is important, and also to not be judgmental about it. I became a vegetarian in that environment where people ate meat three times a day, usually, when I was in my early 20s. And it was because I didn't want to eat meat. I didn't like it. Well, that's fair enough, but it's true for everyone. And I think it's a very, very personal choice. So as long as we are sensitive to the ramifications of our actions and make our choices with that in mind, there's no perfect solution to practically anything. We live in an environment, in a world that has dark and light comma. It's a mix. It's an incredibly complicated mix. And we can't extricate ourselves in a way that's pure. Only our minds, our intention, our letting go of grasping, of selfing, of my making and I making. That's the only way the mind is really purified. And our actions will then become less and less harmful for the world. So thank you for that reflection, Michael. It's a huge help to the environment, even to reduce our meat consumption to like once or twice a week. And then in observing what it does to the body, that was how I got started. I'd eat meat, just two meals a week. And then I could see that like the 24 hours after eating a meat meal, I would get really hot. Like, you know, it has an effect on the body, and your body adjusts. So it takes a little time. And some people try vegetarianism or veganism and throw up their hands after a week or two. You got to give it a little more if you really want to see if your body is able to adjust and be healthy and happy. Just some thoughts. No hands. Forrest, please go ahead.
Hi, Aya.
Hi.
So I have a question about what you said about making change in policy, advocating for policies or calling lawmakers or that kind of thing. One of my fears around that is I feel like a lot of times policy seems like the ramifications are really complex, and I don't want to be ignorant. And like when I was in San Francisco, I would vote on all the props, and like, you know, I don't really know what the ramifications are, even if they sound good. I guess, like, realistically, how, like, easy is it to go about being informed enough to make good decisions? Because I know I could spend like a lot of time educating myself, but I also don't know if that's the best use of my time.
Well, I will share what my solution is, because it's probably pretty obvious that our intention in the holy life is to spend most of our energy and focus on Dhamma, both in practice and study. So I too, like you, do not feel like I understand all the ins and outs of the props and other things about candidates, but I have good friends who are very active in the political scene, who have really researched, and even when we don't have anyone immediately available, like when we lived in downtown Mountain View, we knew that the couple on the corner had been very active in the local politics, and so we went to visit. And I find that, you know, if you find people who have a similar ideology to yours, so that you can feel pretty confident that they're looking at the issues from a perspective that you can align with, that you appreciate, that you feel is sound. And then use their, we're in this together. We all can't know everything. I know we've really realized that we are in a world of diverse education and experience, and we have to help each other. So that's what I would advise, you know, find people who are really in the know. They can kind of digest it for you like a mother bird and feed you what you need to know what to do in a responsible way.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, Anne?
So I just want to agree with you on the last point and also understand Forrest's position. I mean, there are so many propositions and there is so much to know. And so I rely on a nonprofit, Tuolumne River Trust. I think that's what it's called. And they're really good on water policy. And, you know, we don't hear much about water policy, but it's really crucial in California and in the Bay Area. So, you know, I will follow their lead. And actually, that's one of the environmental groups that I donate to, because there are so many groups to donate to. So that to find, you know, it could be any environmental group that you know about and select. And similarly, you know, in terms of the poverty and the women's, the importance of women, in this whole thing, Buddhist Global Relief is the charity that I support, because they just have really, I just trust their approach. So just to support Aya's thing about find a place and focus, we don't have to know everything, we can't know everything. So thank you.
And yes, and Buddhist Global Relief right now they're in a fundraising. They usually have their events in October. And so 1 o'clock today, there's going to be an online event that would usually be a march or a walk in Berkeley. And Buddhist Global Relief is a really good organization for doing practical things at an amazingly wonderful level to help the environment. So it was started by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi and some of his students, I think back in 2008 perhaps. And when I looked at, I was really interested in the climate problems, and I looked at the projects that they had, and this might have been in 2010 or something, and I saw that their projects very much address those four points that Lester Brown makes, They help people develop sustainable farming methods, so improving the way we produce food and store it, and bringing food security to the poorest people. And also they do a lot to promote women's education and women learning how to develop skills that they can market, and lifting them up out of poverty. Because when you help women in a village either start businesses that we've found are very successful, can be very successful, and or gain an education, as I said before, it really helps. And women have a tendency to get their education and then help their village. So when you educate a woman, it helps her children to also eventually gain an education. It starts a very positive cycle. She helps her family, she helps her village, she helps her country. And it's not about me and going after some great gain for the self. Most of the time, the women are really super changers of their whole environment. Their whole village can be uplifted because of one woman. And so this is something that Buddhist Global Relief focuses on. They also focus sometimes on direct food aid, pulling people out of some of the most dire conditions to just sustain life. There's another focus that they do. I can't remember at the moment. But it's like if you look at their program, the projects that they select to support, you'll see an active grassroots support of the environment. And that is powerful. And I've shared with some of you before, I found for myself, I couldn't give to all these different organizations that ask for money, even though they have very good causes. So I would try to find one that really aligned with what I felt was important and get deeply involved in it. And if we're involved in it, we know how the money gets spent. And we know what they're actually doing. Because, you know, even organizations that have a very good mission, they might have gotten a little off base administratively. And we have to be aware of that and make sound wise choices. And rely on other people that we trust who know more about the issues that we're looking at. Do you have any Dhamma lessons in your life from nature that you would like to share? Olivia, please go ahead.
Thank you, Aya. I have a question, not a lesson yet, maybe in a year. The question I have is around where this balance of one's time, it actually came up this morning as well on, I was reading on Sutta Central, people were talking about the just really ridiculous amount of poverty that the world is in, and this kind of balance between giving our time and our energy to the Dhamma and our own awakening and the awakening of others, and then the time and energy that we spend and money on things that are of the direct material well-being, whether that's the environment, poverty, education, which I think all go together, as you've discussed, but sort of, it's been a sort of existential question of mine for a while, having gone to, you know, and probably a lot of people on this call or in the Buddhist world have been educated in like a liberal environment. And, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on activism. And yeah, I don't know how to strike that balance, or like, if the Buddha had words specifically around that?
I think the way to hold it is that we make everything that we do a gift. So we work with the heart, and where the heart is, where our intention is with whatever we're doing. And as we do that, if we are really practicing in that way, selfless, then we notice when our own desires and cravings arise, and we notice when we want to be greedy or we become averse or angry, or when any defilement comes in, we see it. And we work with seeing the harm and letting that go, purifying the mind. And so I really like, I mean, the Buddha lived this way. He took time to be in retreat, and he spent most of his time available to help people. And it's when we visit Ajahn Gadha, every day he talks about giving. Every day he talks about, you know, make everything that you're doing a gift, because it is, it can be, even when you're sitting in meditation, even when you're watering your plants, even when you're, you know, like, you know, smile. Well, now the smiles have to come from the eyes mostly to people, encouraging words in the right direction. And yes, we can take action, but the decision about when and how comes more soundly, solidly, wisely from stillness in the mind, from taking that time to ground ourselves and to recognize that keeping precepts is a gift. Meditating is a gift. And he said, we don't have to do, you know, 5 or 6 hours a day. We can do an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening. And I know a lot of times when we're working full time, that's not possible either. But whatever amount of time we can give it. And then there is time. We weave the work for the world into the work we do for the company, or the work we do for our own household. And it's wisdom that we use to guide us in making the decision. I mean, sometimes we can come to a place where we're really able to tune in intuitively, like what's the right thing to be focused on right now. And it's not so much about a thinking process or a planning process, but it's a feeling process. If our intentions are good, we will have a better idea of what that should be. So I know it's not like, you know, there's some formula that's perfect for everybody, but it's really that there's a method, a way of approaching this question. Andy, go ahead.
Hi, Aya. I don't know if my audio is kind of chaotic or if you can understand me.
I can understand you.
Okay.
Where are you?
We are going for a COVID testing. So everyone in the family. So yeah, we are driving okay. to the testing. And okay. one question that arose is that how can we face these people that maybe our friends, our family, who kind of say things like racist or misogynist or against the idea of climate change, you know, without, it's because I don't know, I have a policy of non-tolerance to that, but I also have a policy of compassion. So I don't know how to face it sometimes.
Yeah, thank you, Andy. That's a good question. You know, what I what I think we can do is the policy of non-tolerance, I think, is good, but then we have to be kind of prepared and ready for the way in which we express that in the world so that it's, as you say, compassionate, it's understanding. And the best way that I've found is that we say something, but nothing harsh. That what we say is something like, you know, if someone says something that to us, as far as we know, is not true, all we have to say is, I don't believe that. We don't have to say it in a harsh way. We can just say, I don't believe that. And that's just a statement about what you think or what you feel. And no one can argue with that. They might try to convince you, but you can just calmly, hopefully, calmly respond with what you actually know if they do want to talk about it. And the Buddha was very much, especially for the monastics, he made rules against teaching the Dhamma without being asked. You know, we cannot go out on the street corner with a sign and start proclaiming the Dhamma. We are not allowed to try to correct someone in a way that's like, I know what's right and I'm going to tell you about it without the invitation to talk. So what we can do is ask a question, or like the Buddha did many times, he'd see someone practicing in a way that was fruitless. And he would ask them what they're doing and why. He didn't just come out with, that's a fruitless activity. What's the matter with you? You just don't know the Dhamma, do you? Here we go. This is the way it is. That was not his approach. And it obviously wouldn't have worked if it were. So, you know, it's like we can have the non-tolerance, but we can also have the patience and the compassion. And that will save us from becoming exactly what we don't want, exactly what we don't like, strident, angry Buddhists, or strident, angry vegetarians. And vegans. I worked in a company where every year at Thanksgiving, there was one person who would send out these horrible messages about how terrible it is that people eat turkey, and they were very bloody and gory messages, and it was just such a turnoff for everybody, and it's not helpful. We have to check, where is my heart? If we can bring our heart to a place of compassion and understanding, doesn't mean we have to agree. Wisdom has to be there to know what's good and what's not good, wholesome and not wholesome, and then from that, say a little bit. And see if there's an interest in learning more. And from that, we say enough to let people know that we don't agree. This is not, in accord with the Dhamma. The Buddha would say that. That's not the way we do it in the Noble One's discipline. And then so this person's interested. Okay, how do you do it in the Noble One's discipline? But if they're not interested, if they walk away saying, I don't agree with that, and the Buddha, this happened, you know, I don't agree with that. This one man went outside the gates of the monastery. There were a bunch of men sitting around gambling, and he comes to them and he says, what do you think about this? And they say, oh, this is what we think. And it's the opposite of what the Buddha had said. And he says, yeah, I go with the gamblers. I believe them. Like, okay, what are you going to do about that? Just let that go. The Buddha wasn't tracking people down to try to get them to hear, and he wasn't making himself unhappy or miserable because people don't realize. But even if in the moment it looks like, you know, if someone's making a racist comment and you make some gentle statement like, you know, for me, I cannot say that. I cannot say to someone of color, get over it. I cannot say to someone, you know, about someone, this thing that's mean or hateful or hurtful. And I don't even have to identify it as mean, hateful, or hurtful. I could say, I could not say that. Or, you know, something that lets them know. And they may just like react negatively, act like they don't care, like you're being foolish or naive, but you never know what they think about later. Later, it might sink in. Just hold your ground and be patient and clear.
Thanks, Haya.
And I hope everyone in the car is are they hearing all this?
Oh, no, because I have earphones.
Okay.
I don't know if I can make a follow-up if there's anyone who wants to ask a question. So, to make a follow-up of this question.
I don't know. We'll see. Thank you. Yeah. So I hope everyone is clear of COVID, and I hope that the whole journey and testing turn out to be reassuring and easy.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I think there are quite a few people who have wanted to go eat lunch or something, which I hope is nice and easy on the environment. And, you know, I want to really express my appreciation for Anne and the work that she's doing with IMC and the Eco Chaplaincy. And encourage people. There are many ways that you can find to. Oh, I didn't understand that. Maybe Lynn is right. Andy, did you have a follow-up question? Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that. Go ahead.
Yeah. I don't know if I can make it.
Sure.
Okay. There's a lot of sound. Okay, I'm trying to remember the question. For example, how, in the Buddhist point of view, how can we face all these protests that I really agree with the protests? And here, for example, in Mexico, there's been a lot of protests about women, and they also do some graffiti and all this stuff, and people just blame them, no? As if they were the ones of the problem. But it's this issue about violence can't be solved with more violence. But I really say that, okay, if you want to prevent these things, you should ensure justice. So I don't know how to face that issue about protests, having violence, and being empathic with the people.
It's a really hard problem, I know, and it may take a long time. As I'm sure you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was an incredible force in the U.S. To bring about more justice with regards to gender and the oppression of women. And it's a very long process. And even when gains are made, then there are elements that push back and roll back some of the progress that's made. And I know first and foremost, protect yourself, try to stay out of situations where you encounter people who have such ignorance and hatred and and delusion. So it's like, first and foremost, try to protect yourself. And then if you find any way to connect with other people who have your same views and see if there's something that can be done to help bring about a different point of view. And we do see that societies change, and it all starts with individuals. And, you know, at first one person maybe, and then a few more come together. And gradually over time, they can really make a difference and make changes. But it's good to not get so caught up in the defilements that are manifest in these situations, because there's only so much we can do. And then hopefully in Mexico, there will come a time when women are more protected and more respected. And, you know, if you can find people who have those values and have that interest, always try to come to it from a place of peace. Because as you mentioned, anger and violence, while it may feel like we're strong, we're not. And if we can find other people who keep the values of being peaceful and kind, even though pushing against these wrong ideas and terrible actions, that's how we need to proceed. And to not have high expectations about how quickly that will happen. So that's why it's important. Protect yourself as much as you can at the same time. That's about all I know on that count. You know, we can wish for a more pure world, and we can make a difference where we are, and even quite far-reaching. But it is samsara, and greed, hatred, and delusion is part of what we're here experiencing. So we have to just accept that reality too. It doesn't mean we're complacent or never give up. Sorry, I didn't understand right away. I hope that answered your question. Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. So it's 12 o'clock, and I want to again thank everyone for being online and for your practice. I really wish you strength and peace and endurance and ways of finding support in everything that you do for the benefit of developing your own mind and heart. And I think I'd like to just chant a blessing for all of you. Remember that everything that you do that's good makes benefit in the world. First of all, at that time, you're not doing anything to drag the world down. You're doing things to build the world up in a good way. And also that you can bring to mind anyone that you'd like to share the merit of your practice with. So I'll just chant a blessing. And I think most of you know what these words mean. May you have every good blessing. May all the devas protect you by the power of all the Buddhas. May you ever be well. May you have every good blessing. May all the devas protect you by the power of all the Dhamma. May you ever be well. May you have every good blessing. May all the devas protect you by the power of all the Sangha. May you ever be well. May all of the natural world benefit from our efforts. Thank you.